Hearts of Three by Jack London. Chapter 1. Events happened very rapidly with Francis Morgan that late spring morning. If ever a man leaped across time into the raw red drama and tragedy of the primitive and the medieval melodrama of sentiment and passion of the New World Latin, Francis Morgan was destined to be that man, and destiny was very immediate upon him. Yet he was lazily unaware that aught in the world was stirring, and was scarcely astir himself. A late night at bridge had necessitated a late rising. A late breakfast of fruit and cereal had occurred along the route to the library, the austerely elegant room from which his father, toward the last, had directed vast and manifold affairs.
"Parker," he said to the valet, who had been his father's before him, "did you ever notice any signs of fat on R.H.M. in his last days?"
"Oh, no, sir,"
was the answer, uttered with all the due humility of the trained servant, but accompanied by an involuntarily measuring glance that scanned the young man's splendid proportions.
"Your father, sir, never lost his leanness. His figure was always the same, broad-shouldered, deep in the chest, big-boned, but lean, always lean, sir, in the middle. When he was laid out, sir, and bathed, his body would have shamed most of the young men about town. He always took good care of himself. It was those exercises in bed, sir, half an hour every morning. Nothing prevented. He called it religion."
"Yes, he was a fine figure of a man,"
the young man responded idly, glancing to the stock ticker and the several telephones his father had installed.
"He was that,"
Parker agreed eagerly.
"He was lean and aristocratic, in spite of his shoulders and bone and chest, and you've inherited it, sir, only along more generous lines."
Young Francis Morgan, inheritor of many millions, as well as brawn, lolled back luxuriously in a huge leather chair, stretched his legs after the manner of a full-vigoured menagerie lion that is overspilling with vigour, and glanced at a headline of the morning paper, which informed him of a fresh slide in the Culebra Holdings in Panama.
"If I didn't know we Morgans didn't run that way," he yawned, "I'd be fat already from this existence. Eh, Parker?"
The elderly valet, who had neglected prompt reply, startled at the abrupt, interrogative interruption of the pause.
"Oh, yes, sir,"
he said hastily.
"I mean, no, sir. You are in the pink of condition."
"Not on your life,"
the young man assured him.
"I may not be getting fat, but I'm certainly growing soft. Eh, Parker?"
"Yes, sir. No, sir. You're just the same as when you came home from college 3 years ago."
"And took up loafing as a vocation,"
Francis laughed.
"Parker!"
Parker was alert attention. His master debated with himself ponderously, as if the problem were of profound importance, rubbing the while the bristly thatch of the small toothbrush moustache he had recently begun to sport on his upper lip.
"Park, I'm going fishing."
"Yes, sir."
"I ordered some rods sent up. Please joint them and let me give them the once-over. The idea drifts through my mind that 2 weeks in the woods is what I need. If I don't, I'll surely start laying on flesh and disgrace the whole family tree. You remember Sir Henry? The old, original Sir Henry, the buccaneer old swashbuckler?"
"Yes, sir, I've read of him, sir."
Parker had paused in the doorway until such time as the ebbing of his young master's volubility would permit him to depart on the errand.
"Nothing to be proud of, the old pirate."
"Oh, no, sir,"
Parker protested.
"He was governor of Jamaica. He died respected."
"It was a mercy he didn't die hanged,"
Francis laughed.
"As it was, he is the only disgrace in the family that he founded. But what I was going to say is that I've looked him up very carefully. He kept his figure, and he died lean in the middle, thank God. It's a good inheritance he passed down. We Morgans never found his treasure, but beyond rubies is the lean-in-the-middle legacy he bequeathed us. It's what's called a fixed character in the breed. That's what the profs taught me in the biology course.
Parker faded out of the room in the ensuing silence, during which Francis Morgan buried himself in the Panama column and learned that the canal was not expected to be open for traffic for 3 weeks to come. A telephone buzzed, and through the electric nerves of a consummate civilization, destiny made the first outreach of its tentacles and contacted with Francis Morgan in the library of the mansion his father had builded on Riverside Drive.
"But my dear Mrs. Carruthers," was his protest into the transmitter, "whatever it is, it is a mere local flurry. Tampico Petroleum is all right. It is not a gambling proposition. It is a legitimate investment. Stay with. Tie to it. Some Minnesota farmer's come to town and is trying to buy a block or two because it looks as solid as it really is. What if it is up 2 points? Don't sell. Tampico Petroleum is not a lottery or a roulette proposition. It's a bona fide industry. I wish it hadn't been so almighty big, or I'd have financed it all myself. Listen, please, it's not a flyer. Our present contracts for tanks is over $1 million. Our railroad and our 3 pipelines are costing more than $5 million. Why, we've $100 million in producing wells right now. And our problem is to get it down country to the oil steamers. This is the sober investment time. A year from now, or 2 years, and your shares will make government bonds look like something the cat brought in. Yes, yes, please. Never mind how the market goes. Also, please, I didn't advise you to go in the first place. I never advised a friend to that. But now that they are in, stick. It's as solid as the Bank of England. Yes, Dickie and I divided the spoils last night. Lovely party. Though Dickie's got too much temperament for bridge. Yes, bull luck. My temperament. Yes? Tell Harry I'm off and away for a couple of weeks. Fishing, troutlets, you know. The springtime and the streams, the rise of sap, the budding and the blossoming and all the rest. Yes. Goodbye. And hold on to Tampico Petroleum. If it goes down after that Minnesota farmer's bulled it, buy a little more. Well, I'm going to. It's like finding money. Yes. Yes, surely. It's too good to dare sell on a flyer now, because it mayn't ever again go down. Of course I know what I'm talking about. I've just had 8 hours' sleep and haven't had a drink. Yes, yes. Goodbye.
He pulled the ticker tape into the comfort of his chair and languidly ran over it, noting with mildly growing interest the message it conveyed. Parker returned with several slender rods, each a glittering gem of artisanship and art. Francis was out of his chair, ticker flung aside and forgotten, as, with the exultant joy of a boy, he examined the toys and, one after another, began trying them, switching them through the air till they made shrill whip-like noises, moving them gently and with prudence and precision under the lofty ceiling as he made believe to cast across the floor into some unseen pool of trout-lurking mystery. A telephone buzzed. Irritation was swift on his face.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, answer it, Parker," he commanded. "If it is some silly stock-gambling female, tell her I'm dead or drunk or down with typhoid or getting married or... anything calamitous.
After a moment's dialogue, conducted on Parker's part, in the discreet and modulated tones that befitted absolutely the cool, chaste, noble dignity of the room, with a "One moment, sir," into the transmitter, he muffled the transmitter with his hand and said,
"It is Mr. Bascombe, sir. He wants you."
"Tell Mr. Bascombe to go to hell," said Francis,
simulating so long a cast that, had it been in verity a cast, and had it pursued the course his fascinated gaze indicated, it would have gone through the window and most likely startled the gardener outside, kneeling over the rose bush he was planting.
"Mr. Bascombe says it's about the market, sir, and that he'd like to talk with you only a moment,"
Parker urged, but so delicately and subduedly as to seem to be merely repeating an immaterial and unnecessary message.
"All right."
Francis carefully leaned the rod against a table and went to the phone.
"Hello?"
he said into the telephone.
"Yes, this is I, Morgan. Shoot. What is it?"
He listened for a minute, then interrupted irritably.
"Sell hell! Nothing of the sort." "Of course, I'm glad to know. Even if it goes up 10 points, which it won't, hold on to everything. It may be a legitimate rise, and it mayn't ever come down. It's solid. It's worth far more than it's listed. Well, I know, if the public doesn't. A year from now it'll list at 200. That is, if Mexico can cut the revolution stuff. Whenever it drops, you'll have buying orders from me." "Nonsense! Who wants control? It's purely sporadic." "Eh? I beg your pardon? I mean, it's merely temporary. Now, I'm going off fishing for a fortnight. If it goes down 5 points, buy. Buy all that's offered. Say, when a fellow's got real bona fide property, being bald is almost as bad as having the bears after one." "Yes. Sure. Yes. Goodbye."
And while Francis returned delightedly to his fishing rods, Destiny, in Thomas Regan's downtown private office, was working overtime. Having arranged with his various brokers to buy, and through his divers channels of secret publicity, having let slip the cryptic tip that something was wrong with Tampico Petroleum's concessions from the Mexican government, Thomas Regan studied a report of his own oil expert emissary, who had spent 2 months on the spot, spying out what Tampico Petroleum really had in sight and prospect. A clerk brought in a card with the information that the visitor was importunate and foreign. Regan listened, glanced at the card, and said,
"Tell us, Mr. Senior Alvarez Torres of Ciudad de Colón, that I can't see him."
5 minutes later, the clerk was back, this time with a message penciled on the card. Regan grinned as he read it.
"Dear Mr. Regan, honored sir, I have the honor to inform you that I have a tip on the location of the treasure Sir Henry Morgan buried in old pirate days, Alvarez Torres."
Regan shook his head, and the clerk was nearly out of the room when his employer suddenly recalled him.
Show him in at once.
In the interval of being alone, Regan chuckled to himself as he rolled the new idea over in his mind.
"The unlicked cub,"
he muttered through the smoke of the cigar he was lighting.
"Thinks he can play the lion part old R.H.M. played. A trimmin' is what he needs. An old gray-haired Thomas R. will see that he gets it."
Señor Alvarez Torres's English was as correct as his modish spring suit, and though the bleached yellow of his skin advertised his Latin American origin, and though his black eyes were eloquent of the mixed lustres of Spanish and Indian long compounded, nevertheless, he was as thoroughly New Yorkish as Thomas Regan could have wished.
By great effort and years of research, I have finally won to the clue of the buccaneer's gold of Sir Henry Morgan, he preambled. Of course, it's on the Mosquito Coast. I'll tell you now that it's not 1,000 miles from the Chiriqui Lagoon, and that Bocas del Toro, within reason, may be described as the nearest town. I was born there, educated in Paris, however, and I know the neighborhood like a book. A small schooner. The outlay is cheap, most very cheap, but the returns, the reward, the treasure.
Señor Torres paused in eloquent inability to describe more definitely, and Thomas Regan, hard man, used to dealing with hard men, proceeded to bore into him and his data like a cross-examining criminal lawyer.
Yes, Señor Torres quickly admitted, I am somewhat embarrassed, how shall I say, for immediate funds.
You need the money,
the stock operator assured him brutally, and he bowed pained acquiescence. Much more, he admitted under the rapid-fire interrogation. It was true, he had but recently left Bocas del Toro, but he hoped never again to go back. And yet he would go back, if possibly some arrangement. But Regan shut him off with the abrupt way of the masterman dealing with lesser fellow creatures. He wrote a check in the name of Alvarez Torres, and when that gentleman glanced at it, he read the figures of $1,000.
Now here's the idea, said Regan. I put no belief whatsoever in your story, but I have a young friend. My heart is bound up in the boy, but he is too much about town, the white lights and the white-lighted ladies and the rest, you understand?
And Señor Alvarez Torres bowed as one man of the world to another.
Now, for the good of his health, as well as his wealth, and the saving of his soul, the best thing that could happen to him is a trip after treasure, adventure, exercise, and, well, you readily understand, I'm sure.
Again, Alvarez Torres bowed.
You need the money,
Regan continued.
Strive to interest him. That $1,000 is for your effort. Succeed in interesting him so that he departs after old Morgan's gold, and $2,000 more is yours. So thoroughly succeed in interesting him that he remains away 3 months, $2,000 more. 6 months, $5,000. Oh, believe me, I knew his father. We were comrades, partners, I might say almost brothers. I would sacrifice any sum to win his son to manhood's wholesome path. What do you say? The $1,000 is yours to begin with. Well?
With trembling fingers, Señor Alvarez Torres folded and unfolded the check.
I accept.
He stammered and faltered in his eagerness.
How shall I say? I am yours to command.
5 minutes later, as he arose to go, fully instructed in the part he was to play, and with his story of Morgan's treasure revised to convincingness by the brass-tack business acumen of the stock gambler, he blurted out, almost facetiously, yet even more pathetically.
And the funniest thing about it, Mr. Regan, is that it is true. Your advice to changes in my narrative make it sound more true, but true it is, under it all. I need the money. You are most munificent, and I shall do my best. I pride myself that I am an artist. But the real and solemn truth is that the clue to Morgan's buried loot is genuine. I have had access to records inaccessible to the public, which is neither here nor there. For the men of my own family, they are family records, have had similar access, and have wasted their lives before me in the futile search. Yet were they on the right clue, except that their wits made them miss the spot by 20 miles. It was there in the records. They missed it because it was, I think, a deliberate trick, a conundrum, a puzzle, a disguisement, a maze, which I, and I alone have penetrated and solved. The early navigators all played such tricks on the charts they drew. My Spanish race so hid the Hawaiian Islands by 5 degrees of longitude.
All of which was in turn Greek to Thomas Regan, who smiled his acceptance of listening, and with the same smile conveyed his busy businessman's tolerant unbelief. Scarcely was Señor Torres gone when Francis Morgan was shown in.
"Just thought I'd drop around for a bit of counsel," he said, greetings over. "And to whom but you should I apply, who so closely played the game with my father? You and he were partners, I understand, on some of the biggest deals. He always told me to trust your judgment. And, well, here I am. And I want to go fishing. What's up with Tampico Petroleum?"
"What is up?"
Regan countered, with fine simulation of ignorance of the very thing of moment he was responsible for precipitating.
"Tampico Petroleum?"
Francis nodded, dropped into a chair, and lighted a cigarette, while Regan consulted the ticker.
"Tampico Petroleum is up. 2 points. You should worry,"
he opined.
"Well, that's what I say,"
Francis concurred.
"I should worry. But just the same, do you think some bunch onto the inside value of it, and it's big, I speak under the rose, you know, I mean, in absolute confidence?"
Regan nodded.
"It is big. It is right. It is the real thing. It is legitimate. Now, this activity, would you think that somebody or some bunch is trying to get control?"
His father's associate, with a reverend grey of hair thatching his roof of crooked brain, shook the thatch.
"Why," he amplified, "it may be just a flurry, or it may be a hunch on the stock public that it's really good. What do you say?"
"Well, of course it's good,"
was Francis's warm response.
"I've got reports, Regan, so good they'll make your hair stand up. As I tell all my friends, this is the real legitimate. It's a damned shame I had to let the public in on it. It was so big, I just had to. Even all the money my father left me couldn't swing it. I mean, free money, not the stuff tied up. Money to work with."
"Are you short?"
the older man queried.
"Oh, I've got a tidy bit to operate with,"
was the airy reply of youth.
"You mean?"
"Sure, just that. If she drops, I'll buy. It's finding money."
"Just about how far would you buy?"
was the next searching interrogation, masked by an expression of mingled good humour and approbation.
"All I've got,"
came Francis Morgan's prompt answer.
"I tell you, Regan, it's immense."
"I hadn't looked into it to amount to anything, Francis, but I will say from the little I know that it listens good."
"Listens? I tell you, Regan, it's the Simon Pure Straight Legitimate, and it's a shame to have it listed at all. I don't have to wreck anybody or anything to pull it across. The world will be better for my shooting into it. I'm afraid to say how many hundreds of millions of barrels of real oil... Say, I've got one well alone in the Huasteca field that's gushed 27,000 barrels a day for 7 months. And it's still doing it. That's the drop in the bucket we've got piped to market now. And it's 22 gravity, and carries less than 0.2% of sediment. There's one gusher, 60 miles of pipe to build to it, and pinched down to the limit of safety, that's pouring out all over the landscape just about 70,000 barrels a day. Of course, all in confidence, you know. We're doing nicely, and I won't want Tampico Petroleum to skyrocket."
"Don't you worry about that, my lad. You've got to get your oil piped and the Mexican Revolution straightened out before ever Tampico Petroleum soars. You go fishing and forget it.
Regan paused, with finely simulated sudden recollection, and picked up Alvarez Torres's card with a penciled note.
Oh, look who's just been to see me.
Apparently struck with an idea, Regan retained the card a moment.
Ah, why go fishing for mere trout? After all, it's only recreation. Here's a thing to go fishing after. There's real recreation in. Full-size man's recreation, and not the Persian palace recreation of an Adirondack camp with ice and servants and electric push buttons. Your father always was more than a mite proud of that old family pirate. He claimed to look like him, and you certainly look like your dad.
Sir Henry, Francis smiled, reaching for the card.
So am I a mite proud of the old scoundrel.
He looked up questioningly from the reading of the card.
He's a plausible cuss, Regan explained. Claims to have been born right down there on the Mosquito Coast, and to have got the tip from private papers in his family. Not that I believe a word of it. I haven't time or interest to get started believing in stuff outside of my own field.
Just the same, Sir Henry died practically a poor man, Francis asserted, the lines of the Morgan's stubbornness knitting themselves for a flash on his brows. And they never did find any of his buried treasure.
Good fishing,
Regan girded good-humouredly.
I'd like to meet this Alvarez Torres just the same, the young man responded.
Ah, fool's gold, Regan continued. Though I must admit that the cuss is most exasperatingly plausible. Why, if I were younger... But, oh, the devil, my work's cut out for me here.
Do you know where I can find him?
Francis was asking the next moment, all unwittingly putting his neck into the net of tentacles that destiny, in the visible incarnation of Thomas Regan, was casting out to snare him. The next morning, the meeting took place in Regan's office. Señor Alvarez Torres startled and controlled himself at first sight of Francis's face. This was not missed by Regan, who grinningly demanded,
"Looks like the old pirate himself, eh?"
"Yes, the resemblance is most striking,"
Torres lied, or half-lied, for he did recognize the resemblance to the portraits he had seen of Sir Henry Morgan, although at the same time, under his eyelids, he saw the vision of another and living man who, no less than Francis and Sir Henry, looked as much like both of them as either looked like the other. Francis was youth that was not to be denied. Modern maps and ancient charts were pored over, as well as old documents, handwritten in faded ink on time-yellowed paper. And at the end of half an hour, he announced that the next fish he caught would be on either the bull or the calf, the two islets off the lagoon of Chiriqui, on one or the other of which Torres averred the treasure lay.
"I'll catch tonight's train for New Orleans," Francis announced. "That will just make the connection with one of the United Fruit Company's boats for Colon. Oh, I had it all looked up before I slept last night."
"But don't charter a schooner at Colon," Torres advised. "Take the overland trip by horseback to Belen. There's the place to charter, with unsophisticated native sailors and everything else unsophisticated."
"Listens good,"
Francis agreed. "I always wanted to see that country down there."
"You'll be ready to catch tonight's train, Señor Torres?"
"Of course, you understand. Under the circumstances, I'll be the treasurer and foot the expenses."
But at a privy glance from Regan, Alvarez Torres lied with swift efficientness.
"I must join you later, I regret, Mr. Morgan. Some little business that presses. How shall I say, an insignificant little lawsuit that must be settled first. Not that the sum at issue is important, but it is a family matter, and therefore gravely important. We tourists have our pride, which is a silly thing, I acknowledge, in this country, but which, with us, is very serious.
Well, he can join afterward and straighten you out if you've missed the scent, Regan assured Francis. And before it slips your mind, it might be just as well to arrange with Signor Torres some division of the loot, if you ever find it.
Well, what would you say? Francis asked.
Equal division, 50-50, Regan answered,
magnificently arranging the apportionment between the two men of something he was certain did not exist.
And you will follow after as soon as you can? Francis asked the Latin American. Regan, take hold of his little law affair yourself and expedite it, won't you?
Sure, boy, was the answer. And if it's needed, shall I advance cash to Señor Alvarez?
Fine.
Francis shook their hands in both of his.
It will save me bother. And I've got to rush to pack and break engagements and catch that train. Well, so long, Regan. Goodbye, Señor Torres, until we meet somewhere around Bocas del Toro, or in a little hole in the ground on the bull or the calf.
You say you think it's the calf?
Well, until then, adios.
And Señor Alvarez Torres remained with Regan some time longer, receiving explicit instructions for the part he was to play, beginning with retardation and delay of Francis's expedition, and culminating in similar retardation and delay always to be continued.
In short, Regan concluded, I don't almost care if he never comes back. If you can keep him down there for the good of his health that long, and longer.
File 2
Chapter 2 Money, like youth, will not be denied, and Francis Morgan, who was the man legal and nature certain representative of both youth and money, found himself one afternoon, 3 weeks after he had said goodbye to Regan, becalmed close under the land on board his schooner, the Angelique. The water was glassy, the smooth roll scarcely perceptible, and, in sheer ennui and overplus of energy that likewise declined to be denied, he asked the captain, a breed, half Jamaica Negro and half Indian, to order a small skiff over the side.
Looks like I might shoot a parrot or a monkey or something, he explained, searching the jungle-clad shore half a mile away through a 12-power Zeiss glass.
Most problematic, sir, that you are bitten by a labari, which is a deadly viper in these parts, grinned the breed skipper and owner of the Angelique, who, from his Jamaica father, had inherited the gift of tongues.
But Francis was not to be deterred, for at the moment, through his glass, he had picked out, first, in the middle ground, a white hacienda, and second, on the beach, a white-clad woman's form, and further had seen that she was scrutinizing him and the schooner through a pair of binoculars.
"Put the skiff over, skipper," he ordered. "Who lives around here? White folks?"
"The Enrico Solano family, sir," was the answer. "My word! They are important gentlefolk, old Spanish, and they own the entire general landscape from the sea to the Cordillera, and half of the Chiriqui Lagoon as well. They are very poor, most powerful rich in landscape, and they are prideful and fiery as cayenne pepper."
As Francis, in the tiny skiff, rowed shoreward, the skipper's alert eye noted that he had neglected to take along either rifle or shotgun for the contemplated parrot or monkey. And next, the skipper's eye picked up the white-clad woman's figure against the dark edge of the jungle. Straight to the white beach of coral sand, Francis rowed, not trusting himself to look over his shoulder to see if the woman remained or had vanished. In his mind was merely a young man's healthy idea of encountering a bucolic young lady, or a half-wild white woman, for that matter, or, at the best, a very provincial one, with whom he could fool and fun away a few minutes of the calm that fettered the Angélique to immobility. When the skiff grounded, he stepped out, and with one sturdy arm lifted its nose high enough up the sand to fasten it by its own weight. Then he turned around. The beach to the jungle was bare. He strode forward confidently.
Any traveller on so strange a shore had a right to seek inhabitants for information on his way,
was the idea he was acting out. And he, who had anticipated a few moments of diversion merely, was diverted beyond his fondest expectations. Like a jack-in-the-box, the woman, who in the flash of vision vouchsafed him, demonstrated that she was a girl-woman, ripely mature and yet mostly girl, sprang out of the green wall of jungle and with both hands seized his arm. The hearty weight of grip in the seizure surprised him. He fumbled his hat off with his free hand and bowed to the strange woman with the imperturbableness of a Morgan, New York trained and disciplined to be surprised at nothing, and received another surprise, or several surprises compounded. Not alone was it her semi-brunette beauty that impacted upon him with the weight of a blow, but it was her gaze, driven into him, that was all of sternness. Almost it seemed to him that he must know her. Strangers, in his experience, never looked so at one another. The double grip on his arm became a draw as she muttered tensely, "Quick, follow me!" A moment he resisted. She shook him in the fervour of her desire and strove to pull him toward her and after her. With the feeling that it was some unusual game, such as one might meet up with on the coast of Central Africa, he yielded, smilingly, scarcely knowing whether he followed voluntarily or was being dragged into the jungle by her impetuosity.
"Do as I do,"
she shot back at him over her shoulder, by this time leading him with one hand of hers in his. He smiled and obeyed, crouching when she crouched, doubling over when she doubled, while memories of John Smith and Pocahontas glimmered up in his fancy. Abruptly she checked him and sat down, her hand directing him to sit beside her ere she released him, and pressed it to her heart while she panted,
"Thank God! O merciful Virgin!"
In imitation, such having been her will of him, and such seemed to be the cue of the game, he smilingly pressed his own hand to his heart, although he called neither on God nor the Virgin.
"Won't you ever be serious?"
she flashed at him, noting his action. And Francis was immediately and profoundly, as well as naturally, serious.
"My dear lady," he began.
But an abrupt gesture checked him, and, with growing wonder, he watched her bend and listen, and heard the movement of bodies padding down some runway several yards away. With a soft, warm palm pressed commandingly to his, to be silent, she left him with the abruptness that he had already come to consider as customary with her, and slipped away down the runway. Almost he whistled with astonishment. He might have whistled it, had he not heard her voice, not distant, in Spanish, sharply interrogate men whose Spanish voices, half humbly, half insistently, and half rebelliously, answered her. He heard them move on, still talking, and after 5 minutes of dead silence, heard her call for him peremptorily to come out.
"Gosh, I wonder what Regan would do under such circumstances," he smiled to himself as he obeyed.
He followed her, no longer hand in hand, through the jungle to the beach. When she paused, he came beside her and faced her, still under the impress of the fantasy which possessed him that it was a game.
"Tag!"
he laughed, touching her on the shoulder.
"Tag!"
he reiterated.
"You're it!"
The anger of her blazing dark eyes scorched him.
"You fool!"
she cried, lifting her finger with what he considered undue intimacy to his toothbrush moustache.
"As if that could disguise you!"
"But my dear lady," he began to protest his certain unacquaintance with her. Her retort, which broke off his speech, was as unreal and bizarre as everything else which had gone before. So quick was it that he failed to see whence the tiny silver revolver had been drawn, the muzzle of which was not presented merely towards his abdomen, but pressed closely against it.
"My dear lady,"
he tried again.
"I won't talk with you."
She shut him off.
"Go back to your schooner and go away."
He guessed the inaudible sob of the pause ere she concluded.
"Forever."
This time his mouth opened to speech that was aborted on his lips by the stiff thrust of the muzzle of the weapon into his abdomen.
"If you ever come back, the Madonna forgive me, I shall shoot myself."
"Guess I'd better go then,"
he uttered airily as he turned to the skiff, toward which he walked in stately embarrassment, half filled with laughter for himself, and for the ridiculous and incomprehensible figure he was cutting. Endeavouring to retain a last shred of dignity, he took no notice that she had followed him. As he lifted the skiff's nose from the sand, he was aware that a faint wind was rustling the palm fronds. A long breeze was darkening the water close at hand, while, far out across the mirrored water, the outlying keys of the Chiriqui Lagoon shimmered like a mirage above the dark, crisping water. A sob compelled him to desist from stepping into the skiff, and to turn his head. The strange young woman, revolver dropped to her side, was crying. His step back to her was instant, and the touch of his hand on her arm was sympathetic and inquiring. She shuddered at his touch, drew away from him, and gazed at him reproachfully through her tears. With a shrug of shoulders to her many moods and of surrender to the incomprehensibleness of the situation, he was about to turn to the boat when she stopped him.
"At least you,"
she began, then faltered and swallowed,
"might kiss me goodbye."
She advanced impulsively with outstretched arms, the revolver dangling incongruously from her right hand. Francis hesitated a puzzled moment, then gathered her in to receive an astounding, passionate kiss on his lips, ere she dropped her head on his shoulder in a breakdown of tears. Despite his amazement, he was aware of the revolver pressing flatwise against his back between the shoulders. She lifted her tear-wet face and kissed him again and again, and he wondered to himself if he were a cad for meeting her kisses with almost equal and fully as mysterious impulsiveness. With a feeling that he did not in the least care how long the tender episode might last, he was startled by her quick drawing away from him, as anger and contempt blazed in her face, and as she menacingly directed him with a revolver to get into the boat. He shrugged his shoulders, as if to say that he could not say no to a lovely lady, and obeyed, sitting to the oars and facing her as he began rowing away.
"The Virgin save me from my wayward heart," she cried, with her free hand tearing a locket from her bosom, and in a shower of golden beads flinging the ornament into the waterway midway between them.
From the edge of the jungle he saw three men, armed with rifles, run toward her where she had sunk down in the sand. In the midst of lifting her up, they caught sight of Francis, who had been rowing a strong stroke. Over his shoulder he glimpsed the Angélique, close-hauled and slightly heeling, cutting through the water towards him. The next moment, one of the trio on the beach, a bearded, elderly man, was directing the girl's binoculars on him, and the moment after, dropping the glasses, he was taking aim with his rifle. The bullet spat on the water within a yard of the skiff's side, and Francis saw the girl spring to her feet, knock up the rifle with her arm, and spoil the second shot. Next, pulling lustily, he saw the men separate from her to sight their rifles, and saw her threatening them with a revolver into lowering their weapons. The Angélique, thrown up into the wind to stop away, foamed alongside, and with an agile leap, Francis was aboard, while already, the skipper putting the wheel up, the schooner was paying off and filling. With boyish zest, Francis wafted a kiss of farewell to the girl, who was staring toward him, and saw her collapse on the shoulders of the bearded elderly man.
Cane Pepper, eh? Those damned, horrible, crazy, proud Solanos.
The breed skipper flashed at Francis with white teeth of laughter.
No, just bugs. Clean crazy. Nobody at home.
Francis laughed back as he sprang to the rail to waft further kisses to the strange damsel. Before the land wind, the Angélique made the outer rim of Chiriqui Lagoon and the Bull and Calf Islands, some 50 miles farther along the rim, by midnight, when the skipper hove to wait for daylight. After breakfast, rowed by a Jamaican Negro sailor in the skiff, Francis landed to reconnoitre on the Bull, which was the larger island, and which the skipper had told him he might find occupied at that season of the year by turtle-catching Indians from the mainland. And Francis very immediately found that he had traversed not merely 30 degrees of latitude from New York, but 30 hundred years, or centuries for that matter, from the last word of civilization to almost the first word of the primeval. Naked, except for breech clouts of gunny sacking, armed with cruelly heavy hacking blades of machetes, the turtle catchers were swift in proving themselves arrant beggars and dangerous man-killers. The Bull belonged to them, they told him, through the medium of his Jamaican sailor's interpreting. But the Calf, which used to belong to them for the turtle season, now was possessed by a madly impossible gringo, whose reckless, dominating ways had won from them the respect of fear for a two-legged human creature who was more fearful than themselves. While Francis, for a silver dollar, dispatched one of them with a message to the mysterious gringo that he desired to call on him, the rest of them clustered about Francis's skiff, whining for money, glowering upon him, and even impudently stealing his pipe, yet warm from his lips, which he had laid beside him in the stern sheets. Promptly he had laid a blow on the ear of the thief, and the next thief who seized it and recovered the pipe. Machetes out, and sun-glistening their clean-slicing menace, Francis covered and controlled the gang with an automatic pistol, and while they drew apart in a group and whispered ominously, he made the discovery that his lone sailor interpreter was a weak brother, and received his returned messenger. The negro went over to the turtle catchers and talked with a friendliness and subservience, the tones of which Francis did not like. The messenger handed him his note, across which was scrawled in pencil, "Vamos."
"Guess I'll have to go across myself," Francis told the negro whom he had beckoned back to him. "Better be very careful and utmostly cautious, sir," the negro warned him. "These animals, without reason, are very problematically likely to act most unreasonably, sir."
"Get into the boat and row me over," Francis commanded shortly.
"No, sir, I regret much to say, sir," was the black sailor's answer. "I signed on, sir, as a sailor to Captain Trevethan, but I didn't sign on for no suicide, and I can't see my way to run you over, sir, to certain death. Best thing we can do is to get out of this hot place. That's certainly, and without peradventure of a doubt, going to get hotter for us if we remain, sir."
In huge disgust and scorn, Francis pocketed his automatic, turned his back on the sacking-clad savages, and walked away through the palms. Where a great boulder of coral rock had been upthrust by some ancient restlessness of the earth, he came down on the beach. On the shore of the Calf, across the narrow channel, he made out a dinghy drawn up. Drawn up on his own side was a crank-looking and manifestly leaky dugout canoe. As he tilted the water out of it, he noticed that the turtle catchers had followed and were peering at him from the edge of the coconuts, though his weak-hearted sailor was not in sight. To paddle across the channel was a matter of moments, but scarcely was he on the beach of the Calf when further inhospitality greeted him on the part of a tall, barefooted young man, who stepped from behind a palm, automatic pistol in hand, and shouted,
"Vamos! Get out! Scut!"
"Ye gods, a little fishes!" Francis grinned half-humorously, half-seriously. "A fellow can't move in these parts without having a gun shoved in his face, and everybody says get out pronto."
Nobody invited you, the stranger retorted. You're intruding. Get off my island. I'll give you half a minute.
I'm getting sore, friend, Francis assured him truthfully, at the same time, out of the corner of his eye, measuring the distance to the nearest palm trunk.
Everybody I meet around here is crazy and discourteous and peevishly anxious to be rid of my presence, and they've just got me feeling that way myself. Besides, just because you tell me it's your island is no proof.
The swift rush he made to the shelter of the palm left his sentence unfinished. His arrival behind the trunk was simultaneous with the arrival of a bullet that thudded into the other side of it.
Now just for that,
he called out as he centered a bullet into the trunk of the other man's palm. The next few minutes they blazed away, or waited for calculated shots, and when Francis's eighth and last had been fired, he was most unpleasantly certain that he had counted only 7 shots for the stranger. He cautiously exposed part of his sun helmet, held in his hand, and had it perforated.
"What gun are you using?"
he asked with cool politeness.
"Colts,"
came the answer. Francis stepped boldly into the open, saying,
"Then you're all out. I counted 'em. 8. Now we can talk."
The stranger stepped out, and Francis could not help admiring the fine figure of him, despite the fact that the dirty pair of canvas pants, a cotton undershirt, and a floppy sombrero constituted his garmenting. Further, it seemed he had previously known him, though it did not enter his mind that he was looking at a replica of himself.
"Talk,"
the stranger sneered, throwing down his pistol and drawing a knife.
"Now we'll just cut off your ears and maybe scalp you."
"Gosh, you're sweet-natured and gentle animals in this neck of the woods,"
Francis retorted, his anger and disgust increasing. He drew his own hunting knife, brand new from the shop and shining.
"Well, let's wrestle and cut out this 10, 20, and 30 knife stuff."
"I want your ears,"
the stranger answered pleasantly as he slowly advanced.
"Sure, first down, and the man who wins the fall gets the other fellow's ears."
"Agreed."
The young man in the canvas trousers sheathed his knife.
"Too bad there isn't a moving picture camera to film this," Francis girded, sheathing his own knife. "I'm sore as a boil. I feel like a heap bad Injun." "Watch out! I'm coming in a rush! Anyway and every way for the first fall!"
Action and word went together, and his glorious rush ended ignominiously, for the stranger, apparently braced for the shock, yielded the instant their bodies met and fell over on his back, at the same time planting his foot in Francis's abdomen, and from the back purchase on the ground, transforming Francis's rush into a wild forward somersault. The fall on the sand knocked most of Francis's breath out of him, and the flying body of his foe, impacting on him, managed to do for what little breath was left him. As he lay speechless on his back, he observed the man on top of him gazing down at him with sudden curiosity.
"What do you want to wear a moustache for?"
the stranger muttered.
"Go on and cut him off,"
Francis gasped, with the first of his returning breath.
"The ears are yours, but the moustache is mine. It's not in the bond. Besides, that fall was straight jiu-jitsu."
"You said anyway and every way for the first fall,"
the other quoted laughingly.
"As for your ears, keep them. I never intended to cut them off. And now that I look at them closely, the less I want them. Get up and get out of here. I've licked you. Vamos. And don't come sneaking round here again. Get, scut!"
In greater disgust than ever, to which was added the humiliation of defeat, Francis turned down to the beach toward his canoe.
"Say, little stranger, do you mind leaving your card?"
the victor called out after him.
"Visiting cards and cutthroating don't go together,"
Francis shot back across his shoulder as he squatted in the canoe and dipped his paddle.
"My name's Morgan."
Surprise and startlement were the stranger's portion, as he opened his mouth to speak, then changed his mind and murmured to himself,
"Same stock. No wonder we look alike."
Still in the throes of disgust, Francis regained the shore of the bull, sat down on the edge of the dugout, filled and lighted his pipe, and gloomily meditated.
"Crazy, everybody,"
was the run of his thought.
"Nobody acts with reason.
I'd like to see old Regan try to do business with these people. They get his ears."
Could he have seen at that moment the young man of the canvas pants and of familiar appearance, he would have been certain that naught but lunacy resided in Latin America. For the young man in question, inside a grass-thatched hut in the heart of his island, grinning to himself as he uttered aloud,
"I guess I could put the fear of God into that particular member of the Morgan family,"
had just begun to stare at a photographic reproduction of an oil painting on the wall of the original Sir Henry Morgan.
"Well, old pirate," he continued, grinning, "two of your latest descendants came pretty close to getting each other with automatics that would make your antediluvian horse pistols look like 30 cents.
He bent to a battered and worm-eaten sea-chest, lifted the lid that was monogrammed with an M, and again addressed the portrait.
"Well, old pirate Welshman of an ancestor, all you've left me is the old duds and a face that looks like yours. I suppose if I was really fired up, I could play your Port-au-Prince stunt about as well as you played it yourself."
A moment later, beginning to dress himself in the age-worn and moth-eaten garments of the chest, he added,
"Well, here's the old duds on my back. Come, Mr. Ancestor, down out of your frame and dare to tell me a point of looks in which we differ."
Clad in Sir Henry Morgan's ancient habiliments, a cutlass strapped on around the middle, and two flintlock pistols of huge and ponderous design thrust into his waist-scarf, the resemblance between the living man and the pictured semblance of the old buccaneer who had been long since resolved to dust was striking.
"Back to back against the mainmast, held at bay the entire crew."
As the young man, picking the strings of a guitar, began to sing the old buccaneer rouse, it seemed to him that the picture of his forebear faded into another picture, and that he saw the old forebear himself, back to a mainmast, cutlass out and flashing, facing a semicircle of fantastically clad sailor cutthroats, while behind him, on the opposite side of the mast, another similarly garbed and accoutred man, with cutlass flashing, faced the other semicircle of cutthroats that completed the ring about the mast. The vivid vision of his fancy was broken by the breaking of a guitar string, which he had thrummed too passionately. And in the sharp pause of silence, it seemed that a fresh vision of old Sir Henry came to him, down out of the frame and beside him, real in all seeming, plucking at his sleeve to lead him out of the hut, and whispering a ghostly repetition of,
"Back to back against the mainmast, held at bay the entire crew."
The young man obeyed his shadowy guide, or some prompting of his own profound intuition, and went out of the door and down to the beach, where, gazing across the narrow channel on the beach of the bull, he saw his late antagonist, backed up against the great boulder of coral rock, standing off an attack of sack-clouted, machete-wielding Indians with wide sweeping strokes of a driftwood timber. And Francis, in extremity, swaying dizzily from the blow of a rock on his head, saw the apparition, that almost convinced him he was already dead and in the realm of the shades, of Sir Henry Morgan himself, cutlass in hand, rushing up the beach to his rescue. Further, the apparition, brandishing the cutlass and laying out Indians right and left, was bellowing,
"Back to back against the mainmast, held at bay the entire crew!"
As Francis's knees gave under him, and he slowly crumpled and sank down, he saw the Indians scatter and flee before the onslaught of the weird pirate figure, and heard their cries of,
"Heaven help us! The Virgin protect us! It's the ghost of old Morgan!"
Francis next opened his eyes inside the grass hut in the midmost centre of the calf. First, in the glimmering of sight of returning consciousness,
he beheld the pictured lineaments of Sir Henry Morgan staring down at him from the wall. Next, it was a younger edition of the same, in three dimensions of living, moving flesh, who thrust a mug of brandy to his lips and bade him drink. Francis was on his feet ere he touched lips to the mug, and both he and the stranger man, moved by a common impulse, looked squarely into each other's eyes, glanced at the picture on the wall, and touched mugs in a salute to the picture and to each other ere they drank.
"You told me you were a Morgan," the stranger said. "I'm a Morgan. That man on the wall fathered my breed. Your breed?"
"The old Buccaneers," Francis returned. "My first name is Francis. And yours?"
"Henry, straight from the original. We must be remote cousins or something or other. I'm after the foxy old, niggardly old Welshman's loot."
"So am I," said Francis, extending his hand.
"But to hell with sharing." "Ah, the old blood talks in you." Henry smiled approbation. "For him to have who finds. I've turned most of this island upside down in the last 6 months, and all I've found are these old duds. I'm with you to beat you if I can, but to put my back against the mainmast with you any time the needed call goes out."
"That song's a wonder," Francis urged. "I want to learn it. Lift the stave again." And together, clanking their mugs, they sang,
"Back to back against the mainmast, held at bay the entire crew."
File 3.
Chapter 3. But a splitting headache put a stop to Francis's singing, and made him glad to be swung in a cool hammock by Henry, who rowed off the Angélique with orders from his visitor to the skipper to stay at anchor, but not to permit any of his sailors to land on the Calf. Not until late in the morning of the following day, after hours of heavy sleep, did Francis get on his feet and announce that his head was clear again.
"Ah, I know what it is. Got bucked off a horse once,"
his strange relative sympathized as he poured him a huge cup of fragrant black coffee.
"Drink that down. It'll make a new man of you. Can't offer you much for breakfast except bacon, sea biscuit, and some scrambled turtle eggs. They're fresh, I guarantee that, for I dug them out this morning while you slept."
"That coffee is a meal in itself," Francis praised, meanwhile studying his kinsman and ever and anon glancing at the portrait of their relative.
"You're just like him, and in more than mere looks,"
Henry laughed, catching him in his scrutiny.
"When you refused to share yesterday, it was old Sir Henry to the life. He had a deep-seated antipathy against sharing, even with his own crews. It's what caused most of his troubles. And he's certainly never shared a penny of his treasure with any of his descendants. Now I'm different. Not only will I share the Calf with you, but I'll present you with my half as well. Lock, stock and barrel, this grass hut, all these nice furnishings, tenements, hereditaments, and everything. And what's left of the turtle eggs. When do you want to move in?"
"You mean?"
Francis asked.
"Just that. There's nothing here. I've just about dug the island upside down, and all I found was the chest there full of old clothes."
"Well, it must have encouraged you."
Mightily. I thought I had a hammerlock on it. At any rate, it showed I'm on the right track."
"What's the matter with trying the bull?"
Francis queried.
"That's my idea right now," was the answer. "Though I've got another clue for over on the mainland. Those old-timers had a way of noting down their latitude and longitude whole degrees out of the way."
10 north and 90 east on the chart might mean 12 north and 92 east,"
Francis concurred.
"Then again, it might mean 8 north and 88 east. They carry the correction in their heads, and if they died unexpectedly, which was their custom, it seems, the secret died with them."
"I've half a notion to go over to the Bull and chase those turtle catchers back to the mainland,"
Henry went on.
"And then again, I'd almost like to tackle the mainland clue first.
I suppose you've got a stock of clues, too.
Certainly, Francis nodded. But, say, I'd like to take back what I said about not sharing.
Say the word,
the other encouraged.
Then I do say it.
Their hands extended and gripped in ratification.
Morgan and Morgan, Strictly Limited, chortled Francis.
Assets, the whole Caribbean Sea, the Spanish Main, most of Central America, one chestful of perfectly no-good old clothes, and a lot of holes in the ground.
Henry joined in the other's humour.
Liabilities, snake bite, thieving Indians, malaria, yellow fever.
And pretty girls with a habit of kissing total strangers one moment, and of sticking up said total strangers with shiny silver revolvers next moment,
Francis cut in.
Day before yesterday, I rode ashore over on the mainland. The moment I landed, the prettiest girl in the world pounced out upon me and dragged me away into the jungle. I thought she was going to eat me or marry me. I didn't know which. And before I could find out, what's the pretty damsel do but pass uncomplimentary remarks on my moustache and chase me back to the boat with a revolver? Told me to beat it and never come back, or words to that effect.
Whereabouts on the mainland was this?
Henry demanded, with a tenseness which Francis, chuckling his reminiscence of the misadventure, did not notice.
Oh, down toward the other end of Chiriqui Lagoon, he replied. It was the stamping ground of the Solano family, I learned, and they're a red peppery family, as I found out. But I haven't told you all. Listen. First, she dragged me into the vegetation and insulted my moustache. Next, she chased me to the boat with a drawn revolver, and then she wanted to know why I didn't kiss her. Can you beat that?
And did you?
Henry demanded, his hand unconsciously clinching by his side.
Oh, what could a poor stranger in a strange land do? It was some armful of pretty girl.
The next fraction of a second, Francis had swung to his feet and blocked before his jaw a crushing blow of Henry's fist.
I beg your pardon,
Henry mumbled, and slumped down on the ancient sea-chest.
I'm a fool, I know, but I'll be hanged if I can stand for—
There you go again,
Francis interrupted resentfully.
As crazy as everybody else in this crazy country. One moment you bandage up my cracked head, and the next moment you want to knock that same head clean off of me. As bad as the girl taking turns at kissing me and shoving a gun into my midriff.
That's right. Fire away. I deserve it,
Henry admitted ruefully, but involuntarily began to fire up as he continued with,
Confound you! That was Leoncia.
Well, what if it was Leoncia, or Mercedes, or Dolores? I mean, can't a fella kiss a pretty girl to revolver's point without having his head knocked off by the next ruffian he meets in dirty canvas pants on a notorious sand heap of an island?
When the pretty girl is engaged to marry the ruffian in the dirty pants.
You don't mean to tell me,
the other broke in excitedly.
It isn't particularly amusing to said ruffian to be told that his sweetheart has been kissing a ruffian she never saw before from off of a disreputable Jamaica nigger's schooner,
Henry completed his sentence.
And she took me for you,
Francis mused, glimpsing the situation.
I don't blame you for losing your temper, although you must admit it's a nasty one. Wanted to cut off my ears yesterday, didn't you?
Yours is just as nasty, Francis, my boy. The way you insisted that I cut them off when I had you down.
Both young men laughed in hearty amity.
It's the old Morgan temper,
Henry said.
He was by all accounts a peppery old cuss.
Yeah, no more peppery than those Solanos you're marrying into. Why, most of the family came down on the beach and peppered me with rifles on my departing way. And your Leoncia pulled her little popgun on a long-bearded old fellow who might have been her father, and who gave him to understand she'd shoot him full of holes if he didn't stop plugging away at me.
It was her father, I'll wager. Old Enrico himself,
Henry exclaimed.
And the other chaps were her brothers.
"Lovely lizards!" ejaculated Francis. "Say, don't you think that life is liable to become a trifle monotonous when you're married into such a peaceful, dove-like family as that?"
He broke off, struck by a new idea.
"By the way, Henry, since they all thought it was you and not I, why in thunderation did they want to kill you? Some more of your crusty Morgan temper that peeved your prospective wife's relatives?"
Henry looked at him a moment, as if debating with himself, and then answered,
"I don't mind telling you. It is a nasty mess, and I suppose my temper was to blame. I quarrelled with her uncle. He was her father's youngest brother."
"Was?"
interrupted Francis, with significant stress on the past tense.
"Was, I said."
Henry nodded.
"He isn't now. His name was Alfaro Solano, and he had some temper himself. They claim to be descended from the Spanish conquistadores, and they are prouder than hornets. He'd made money in logwood, and he'd just got a big henequen plantation started further down the coast. And then we quarrelled. It was in the little town over there, San Antonio. It may well have been a misunderstanding, though I still maintain he was wrong. He always was looking for trouble with me. Didn't want me to marry Leoncia, you see. Well, it was a hot time. It started in a pulqueria where Alvaro had been drinking more mezcal than was good for him. He insulted me, all right. They had to hold us apart and take our guns away, and we separated swearing death and destruction. That was the trouble. Our quarrel and our threats were heard by a score of witnesses. Within 2 hours, the commissario himself and 2 gendarmes found me bending over Alfaro's body in a back street in the town. He'd been knifed in the back, and I'd stumbled over him on the way to the beach. Explain? No such thing. There were the quarrel and the threats of vengeance, and there I was, not 2 hours afterwards, caught dead to right with his warm corpse. I haven't been back in San Antonio since, and I didn't waste any time in getting away. Alfaro was very popular. You know, the dashing type that catches the rabble's fancy. Why, they couldn't have been persuaded to give me even the semblance of a trial. Wanted my blood there and then, and I departed very pronto. Next, up at Bocas del Toro, a messenger from Leoncia delivered back the engagement ring. And there you are. I developed a real big disgust, and since I didn't dare go back with all the Solanos and the rest of the population thirsting for my life, I came over here to play hermit for a while and dig for Morgan's treasure. Just the same, I wonder who did stick that knife into Alfaro. If ever I find him, then I clear myself with Leoncia and the rest of the Solanos, and there isn't a doubt in the world that there'll be a wedding. And now that it's all over, I don't mind admitting that Alfaro was a good scout, even if his temper did go off at half-cock.
Clear as print,
Francis murmured. No wonder her father and brothers wanted to perforate me. Why, the more I look at you, the more I see we're alike as 2 peas, except for my moustache.
And for this...
Henry rolled up his sleeve, and on the left forearm showed a long, thin, white scar.
Got that when I was a boy. Fell off a windmill and through the glass roof of a hothouse.
Now listen to me,
Francis said, his face beginning to light with a project forming in his mind.
Somebody's got to straighten you out of this mess, and the chap's name is Francis, partner in the firm of Morgan and Morgan. You stick around here, or go over and begin prospecting on the bull, while I go back and explain things to Leoncia and her people.
If only they don't shoot you first before you can explain that you are not I,
Henry muttered bitterly.
That's the trouble with these Solanos. They shoot first and talk afterward. They won't listen to reason unless it's post-mortem.
Well, guess I'll take a chance, old man,
Francis assured the other, himself all fire with the plan of clearing up the distressing situation between Henry and the girl. But the thought of her perplexed him. He experienced more than a twinge of regret that the lovely creature belonged of right to a man who looked so much like him, and he saw again the vision of her on the beach, when, with conflicting emotions, she had alternately loved him and yearned toward him, and blazed her scorn and contempt on him. He sighed involuntarily.
"What's that for?"
Henry demanded quizzically.
"Leontia is an exceedingly pretty girl," Francis answered with transparent frankness. "Just the same, she's yours, and I'm going to make it my business to see that you get her." "Where's that ring?" she returned. "If I don't put it on her finger for you, and be back here in a week with the good news, you can cut off my moustache along with my ears."
An hour later, Captain Trevethan, having sent a boat to the beach from the Angelique in response to signal, the two young men were saying goodbye.
"Just two things more, Francis. First, and I forgot to tell you, Leontia is not a Solano at all, though she thinks she is. Alfaro told me himself. She's an adopted child, and old Enrico fairly worships her, though neither his blood nor his race runs in her veins. Alfaro never told me the ins and outs of it, though he did say she wasn't Spanish at all. I don't even know whether she's English or American. She talks good enough English, though she got that at the convent. You see, she was adopted when she was a wee thing, and she's never known anything else than that Enrico is her father."
"And no wonder she scorned and hated me for you," Francis laughed, "believing, as she did, as she still does, that you knifed her full-blood uncle in the back."
Henry nodded and went on.
"The other thing is fairly important, and that's the law. Or the absence of it, rather. They make it whatever they wanted down in this out-of-the-way hole. It's a long way to Panama, and the gobernador of this state or district, or whatever they call it, is a sleepy old Silenus. The Jefe Politico at San Antonio is the man to keep an eye on. He's the little czar of that neck of the woods, and he's some crooked hombre, take it from yours truly. Graft is too weak a word to apply to some of his deals, and he's as cruel and bloodthirsty as a weasel. And his one crowning delight is an execution. He dotes on a hanging. Keep your weather eye on him, whatever you do. And, well, so long. And half of whatever I find on the bull is yours. And see you get that ring back on Leontia's finger."
2 days later, after the half-breed skipper had reconnoitred ashore and brought back the news that all the men of Leontia's family were away, Francis had himself landed on the beach where he had first met her. No maidens with silver revolvers nor men with rifles were manifest. All was placid, and the only person on the beach was a ragged little Indian boy, who, at sight of a coin, readily consented to carry a note up to the young señorita of the big hacienda. As Francis scrawled on a sheet of paper from his notebook, "I am the man whom you mistook for Henry Morgan, and I have a message for you from him," he little dreamed that untoward happenings were about to occur with as equal rapidity and frequence as on his first visit. For that matter, could he have peeped over the out-jut of rock against which he leaned his back while composing the note to Leontia, he would have been startled by a vision of the young lady herself, emerging like a sea-goddess fresh from a swim in the sea. But he wrote calmly on, the Indian lad even more absorbed than himself in the operation, so that it was Leontia, coming around the rock from behind, who first caught sight of him. Stifling an exclamation, she turned and fled blindly into the green screen of jungle. His first warning of her proximity was immediately thereafter, when a startled scream of fear aroused him. Note and pencil fell to the sand as he sprang toward the direction of the cry and collided with a wet and scantily dressed young woman who was recoiling backward from whatever had caused her scream. The unexpectedness of the collision was provocative of a second startled scream from her ere she could turn and recognize that it was not a new attack, but a rescuer. She darted past him, her face colorless from the fright, stumbled over the Indian boy, nor paused until she was out on the open sand.
"What is it?" Francis demanded. "Are you hurt? What's happened?"
She pointed at her bare knee, where two tiny drops of blood oozed forth side by side from two scarcely perceptible lacerations.
"It was a viperine," she said. "A deadly viperine! I shall be a dead woman in 5 minutes. And I am glad, glad, for then my heart will be tormented no more by you."
She levelled an accusing finger at him, gasped the beginning of denunciation she could not utter, and sank down in a faint. Francis knew about the snakes of Central America merely by hearsay, but the hearsay was terrible enough. Men talked of even mules and dogs dying in horrible agony 5 to 10 minutes after being struck by tiny reptiles 15 to 20 inches long. Small wonder she had fainted, was his thought, with so terribly rapid a poison doubtless beginning to work. His knowledge of the treatment of snake bite was likewise hearsay, but flashed through his mind the recollection of the need of a tourniquet to shut off the circulation above the wound and prevent the poison from reaching the heart. He pulled out his handkerchief and tied it loosely around her leg above the knee, thrust in a short piece of driftwood stick, and twisted the handkerchief to savage tightness. Next, and all by hearsay, working swiftly, he opened the small blade of his pocket knife, burned it with several matches to make sure against germs, and cut carefully but remorselessly into the 2 lacerations made by the snake's fangs. He was in a fright himself, working with feverish deftness, and apprehending at any moment that the pangs of dissolution would begin to set in on the beautiful form before him. From all he had heard, the bodies of snake victims began to swell quickly and prodigiously. Even as he finished excoriating the fang wounds, his mind was made up to his next 2 acts. First, he would suck out all poison he possibly could, and next, light a cigarette and with its live end proceed to cauterize the flesh. But while he was still making light criss-cross cuts with the point of his knife blade, she began to move restlessly. "Lie down!" he commanded, as she sat up, and just when he was bending his lips to the task. In response, he received a resounding slap alongside of his face from her little hand. At the same instant, the Indian lad danced out of the jungle, swinging a small dead snake by the tail, and crying exultantly, "Labari! Labari!" at which Francis assumed the worst. "Lie down and be quiet!" he repeated harshly. "You haven't a second to lose!" But she had eyes only for the dead snake. Her relief was patent, but Francis was no witness to it, for he was bending again to perform the classic treatment of snake-bite.
"You dare!" she threatened him. "It's only a baby labari, and its bite is harmless. I thought it was a viperine. They look alike when the labari is small."
The constriction of the circulation by the tourniquet pained her, and she glanced down and discovered his handkerchief knotted around her leg.
"Oh, what have you done?"
A warm blush began to suffuse her face.
"But it was only a baby labari," she reproached him. "You told me it was a viperine," he retorted.
She hid her face in her hands, although the pink of flush burned furiously in her ears. Yet he could have sworn, unless it were hysteria, that she was laughing, and he knew for the first time how really hard was the task he had undertaken to put the ring of another man on her finger. So he deliberately hardened his heart against the beauty and fascination of her, and said bitterly,
"And now I suppose some of your gentry will shoot me full of holes because I don't know a labari from a viperine. You might call some of the farmhands down to do it. Or maybe you'd like to take a shot at me yourself."
But she seemed not to have heard, for she had arisen with the quick litheness to be expected of so gloriously fashioned a creature, and was stamping her foot on the sand.
"It's asleep, my foot,"
she explained, with laughter unhidden this time by her hands.
"You're acting perfectly disgracefully,"
he assured her wickedly,
"when you consider that I am the murderer of your uncle."
Thus reminded, the laughter ceased, and the colour receded from her face. She made no reply, but, bending, with fingers that trembled with anger, she strove to unknot the handkerchief as if it were some loathsome thing.
"Better let me help,"
he suggested pleasantly.
"You beast!"
she flamed at him.
"Step aside! Your shadow falls upon me!"
"Now you are delicious, charming,"
he girded, belying the desire that stirred compellingly within him to clasp her in his arms.
"You quite revive my last recollection of you here on the beach. One second reproaching me for not kissing you, the next second kissing me. Yes, you did, too, and the third second threatening to destroy my digestion forever with that little tin toy pistol of yours. No, you haven't changed an iota from last time. You're the same spitfire of a Leoncia. You'd better let me untie that for you. Don't you see that the knot is jammed? Your little fingers can never manage it."
She stamped her foot in the sheer inarticulateness of rage.
"Lucky for me that you don't make a practice of taking your tin toy pistol in swimming with you," he teased on. "Or else there'd be a funeral right here on the beach pretty pronto of a perfectly nice young man whose intentions are never less than the best."
The Indian boy returned at this moment, running with her bathing wrap, which she snatched from him and put on hastily. Next, with the boy's help, she attacked the knot again. When the handkerchief came off, she flung it from her, as if, in truth, it were a viperine.
"It was contamination,"
she flashed, for his benefit. But Francis, still engaged in hardening his heart against her, shook his head slowly and said,
"It doesn't save you, Leoncia. I've left my mark on you that never will come off."
He pointed to the excoriations he had made on her knee, and laughed.
"The mark of the beast!"
she came back, turning to go.
"I warn you to take yourself off, Mr. Henry Morgan!"
But he stepped in her way.
"And now we'll talk business, Miss Solano," he said in changed tones, "and you will listen. Let your eyes flash all they please, but don't interrupt me."
He stooped and picked up the note he had been engaged in writing.
"I was just sending that to the boy when you screamed. Take it. Read it. It won't bite you. It isn't a viperine."
Though she refused to receive it, her eyes involuntarily scanned the opening line.
"I am the man whom you mistook for Henry Morgan."
She looked at him with startled eyes that could not comprehend much, but which were guessing many vague things.
"On my honour,"
he said gravely.
"You are not Henry?"
she gasped.
"No, I am not. Won't you please take it and read?"
This time she complied, while he gazed with all his eyes upon the golden pallor of the sun on her tropic-touched blonde face, which coloured the blood beneath, or which was touched by the blood beneath, to the amazingly beautiful golden pallor. Almost in a dream, he discovered himself looking into her startled, questioning eyes of velvet brown.
"And who should have signed this?"
she repeated. He came to himself and bowed.
"But the name, your name?"
"Morgan, Francis Morgan. As I explained here, Henry and I are some sort of distant relatives, 45th cousins or something like that."
To his bewilderment, a great doubt suddenly dawned in her eyes, and the old familiar anger flashed.
"Henry,"
she accused him,
"this is a ruse, a devil's trick you're trying to play on me. Of course you are Henry."
Francis pointed to his moustache.
"Oh, you've grown that since,"
she challenged. He pulled up his sleeve and showed her his left arm from wrist to elbow, but she only looked her incomprehension of the meaning of his action.
"Do you remember the scar?"
he asked. She nodded.
"Then find it."
She bent her head in swift, vain search, then shook it slowly as she faltered.
I ask your forgiveness. I was terribly mistaken, and when I think of the way I have treated you."
"That kiss was delightful," he naughtily disclaimed. She recollected more immediate passages, glanced down at her knee, and stifled what he adjudged was a most adorable giggle.
"You say you have a message from Henry?"
She changed the subject abruptly.
"And that he is innocent? This is true? Oh, I do want to believe you."
I am morally certain that Henry no more killed your uncle than did I.
Then say no more. At least, not now,
she interrupted joyfully.
First of all, I must make amends to you, though you must confess that some of the things you have done and said were abominable. You had no right to kiss me.
If you remember, he contended, I did it at the pistol point. Well, how was I to know but what I would get shot if I didn't?
Oh, hush, hush, she begged. You must go with me now to the house. And you can tell me about Henry on the way.
Her eyes chanced upon the handkerchief she had flung so contemptuously aside. She ran to it and picked it up.
Poor, ill-treated kerchief,
she crooned to it.
To you also must I make amends. I shall myself launder you and...
Her eyes lifted to Francis as she addressed him.
And return it to you, fresh and sweet, and all wrapped around my heart of gratitude.
And the mark of the beast?
He queried.
I am so sorry,
she confessed penitently.
And may I be permitted to rest my shadow upon you?
Do, do,
she cried gaily.
There, I am in your shadow now, and we must start.
Francis tossed a peso to the grinning Indian boy, and, in high elation, turned and followed her into the tropic growth on the path that led up to the white hacienda. Seated on the broad piazza of the Solano Hacienda, Alvarez Torres saw through the tropic shrubs the couple approaching along the winding driveway, and he saw what made him grit his teeth and draw very erroneous conclusions. He muttered imprecations to himself and forgot his cigarette. What he saw was Leoncia and Francis in such deep and excited talk as to be oblivious of everything else. He saw Francis grow so urgent of speech and gesture as to cause Leoncia to stop abruptly and listen further to his pleading. Next, and Torres could scarcely believe the evidence of his eyes, he saw Francis produce a ring, and Leoncia, with averted face, extend her left hand and receive the ring upon her third finger. Engagement finger it was, and Torres could have sworn to it. What had really occurred was the placing of Henry's engagement ring back on Leoncia's hand, and Leoncia, she knew not why, had been vaguely averse to receiving it. Torres tossed the dead cigarette away, twisted his moustache fiercely as if to relieve his own excitement, and advanced to meet them across the piazza. He did not return the girl's greeting at the first. Instead, with the wrathful face of the Latin, he burst out at Francis.
One does not expect shame in a murderer, but at least one does expect simple decency.
Francis smiled whimsically.
There it goes again, he said. Another lunatic in this lunatic land. The last time, Leoncia, that I saw this gentleman was in New York. He was really anxious to do business with me. Now I meet him here, and the first thing he tells me is that I am an indecent, shameless murderer.
Señor Torres, you must apologize,
she declared angrily.
The House of Solano is not accustomed to having its guests insulted.
The House of Solano, I then understand, is accustomed to having its men murdered by transient adventurers, he retorted. No sacrifice is too great when it is in the name of hospitality. Get off your foot, Señor Torres,
Francis advised him pleasantly.
You're standing on it. I know what your mistake is. You think I am Henry Morgan. I am Francis Morgan. And you and I, not long ago, transacted business together in Regan's office in New York. There's my hand. Your shaking of it will be sufficient apology under the circumstances.
Torres, overwhelmed for the moment by his mistake, took the extended hand and uttered apologies both to Francis and Leoncia.
And now,
she beamed through laughter, clapping her hands to call a house servant,
I must locate Mr. Morgan, and go and get some clothes on. And after that, Señor Torres, if you will pardon us, we will tell you about Henry.
While she departed, and while Francis followed away to his room on the heels of a young and pretty mestiza woman, Torres, his brain resuming its functions, found he was more amazed and angry than ever. This, then, was a newcomer and stranger to Leoncia, whom he had seen putting a ring on her engagement finger. He thought quickly and passionately for a moment. Leoncia, whom to himself he had always named the queen of his dreams, had, on an instant's notice, engaged herself to a strange gringo from New York. It was unbelievable, monstrous. He clapped his hands, summoned his hired carriage from San Antonio, and was speeding down the drive when Francis strolled forth to have a talk with him about further details of the hiding place of old Morgan's treasure. After lunch, when a land breeze sprang up, which meant fair wind and a quick run across Chiriqui Lagoon and along the length of it to Bullen Calf, Francis, eager to bring to Henry the good word that his ring adorned Leoncia's finger, resolutely declined her proffered hospitality to remain for the night and meet Enrico Solano and his tall sons. Francis had a further reason for his hasty departure. He could not endure the presence of Leoncia, and this in no sense uncomplimentary to her. She charmed him and drew him, to such an extent that he dared not endure her charm and draw if he were to remain man-faithful to the man in the canvas pants, even then digging holes in the sands of the bull. So Francis departed, a letter to Henry from Leoncia in his pocket. The last moment, ere he departed, was abrupt. With a sigh, so quickly suppressed that Leoncia wondered whether or not she had imagined it, he tore himself away. She gazed after his retreating form down the driveway until it was out of sight, then stared at the ring on her finger with a vaguely troubled expression. From the beach, Francis signalled the Angélique, riding at anchor, to send a boat ashore for him. But before it had been swung into the water, half a dozen horsemen, revolver-belted, rifles across their pommels, rode down the beach upon him at a gallop. Two men led. The following four were hangdog half-castes. Of the two leaders, Francis recognized Torres. Every rifle came to rest on Francis, and he could not but obey the order snarled at him by the unknown leader to throw up his hands, and Francis opined aloud, "To think of it! Once! Only the other day! Or was it a million years ago? I thought auction bridge at a dollar a point was some excitement! Now, sirs, you on your horses with your weapons threatening the violent introduction of foreign substances into my poor body, tell me what he's doing now! Don't I ever get off this beach without gunpowder complications? Is it my ears, or merely my moustache you want?"
"We want you," answered the stranger leader, whose moustache bristled as magnetically as his crooked black eyes.
"And in the name of original sin and of all lovely lizards, who might you be?"
"He is the Honorable Señor Mariano Vercara e Hijos, Jefe Politico of San Antonio," Torres replied.
"Good night,"
Francis laughed, remembering the man's description as given to him by Henry.
"I suppose you think I've broken some harbour rule or sanitary regulation by anchoring here. But you must settle things with my captain, Captain Trevethan, a very estimable gentleman. I am only the charterer of the schooner, just a passenger. You will find Captain Trevethan right up in maritime law and custom."
"You are wanted for the murder of Alfaro Solano," was Torres's answer. "You didn't fool me, Henry Morgan, with your talk up at the hacienda that you were someone else. I know that someone else. His name is Francis Morgan, and I do not hesitate to add that he is not a murderer, but a gentleman."
"Ye gods and little fishes," Francis exclaimed. "And yet you shook hands with me, Señor Torres."
"I was fooled," Torres admitted sadly, "but only for a moment. Will you come peaceably?"
"As if."
Francis shrugged his shoulders eloquently at the six rifles.
"I suppose you'll give me a pronto trial and hang me at daybreak."
"Justice is swift in Panama,"
the Jefe Politico replied, his English queerly accented but understandable.
"But not so quick as that. We will not hang you at daybreak. 10 o'clock in the morning is more comfortable all around, don't you think?
Oh, by all means, Francis retorted. Make it 11 or 12 noon. I won't mind.
You will kindly come with us, senor,
Mariano Vercaro e Hijos said, the suavity of his diction not masking the iron of its intention.
Juan, Ignacio,
he ordered in Spanish.
Dismount. Take his weapons. No, it will not be necessary to tie his hands. Put him on the horse behind Gregorio.
Francis, in a venerably whitewashed adobe cell, with walls 5 feet thick, its earth floor carpeted with the forms of half a dozen sleeping peon prisoners, listened to a dim hammering not very distant, remembering the trial from which he had just emerged, and whistled long and low. The hour was 8:30 in the evening. The trial had begun at 8. The hammering was the hammering together of the scaffold beams, from which place of eminence he was scheduled at 10 o'clock next morning to swing off into space, supported from the ground by a rope around his neck. The trial had lasted 30 minutes by his watch. 20 minutes would have covered it had Leoncia not burst in and prolonged it by the 10 minutes courteously accorded her as the great lady of the Solano family. The jefe was right, Francis acknowledged to himself in a matter of soliloquy. Panama justice does move swiftly. The very possession of the letter given him by Leoncia and addressed to Henry Morgan had damned him. The rest had been easy. 30 witnesses had testified to the murder and identified him as the murderer. The jefe politico himself had so testified. The one cheerful note had been the eruption on the scene of Leoncia, chaperoned by a palsied old aunt of the Solano family. That had been sweet. The fight the beautiful girl had put up for his life, despite the fact that it was foredoomed to futility. When she had made Francis roll up the sleeve and expose his left forearm, he had seen the jefe politico shrug his shoulders contemptuously, and he had seen Leoncia fling a passion of Spanish words, too quick for him to follow, at Torres. And he had seen and heard the gesticulation and the roar of the mob-filled courtroom as Torres had taken the stand. But what he had not seen was the whispered colloquy between Torres and the jefe, as the former was in the thick of forcing his way through the press to the witness box. He no more saw this particular side play than did he know that Torres was in the pay of Regan to keep him away from New York as long as possible, and as long as ever, if possible. Nor than did he know that Torres himself, in love with Leoncia, was consumed with a jealousy that knew no limit to its ire. All of which had blinded Francis to the play under the interrogation of Torres by Leoncia, which had compelled Torres to acknowledge that he had never seen a scar on Francis Morgan's left forearm. While Leoncia had looked at the little old judge in triumph, the jefe politico had advanced and demanded of Torres in stentorian tones,
"Can you swear that you ever saw a scar on Henry Morgan's arm?"
Torres had been baffled and embarrassed, and had looked bewilderment to the judge and pleadingness to Leoncia, and, in the end, without speech, shake his head that he could not so swear. The roar of triumph had gone up from the crowd of ragamuffins. The judge had pronounced sentence. The roar had doubled on itself, and Francis had been hustled out and to his cell, not entirely unresistingly, by the gendarme and the commissario, all apparently solicitous of saving him from the mob that was unwilling to wait until 10 next morning for his death.
"That poor dub Torres, who fell down on the scar on Henry," Francis was meditating sympathetically, when the bolts of his cell door shot back and he arose to greet Leoncia. But she declined to greet him for the moment, as she flared at the commissario in rapid-fire Spanish, with gestures of command to which he yielded when he ordered the jailer to remove the peons to the other cells, and himself, with a nervous and apologetic bowing, went out and closed the door. And then Leoncia broke down,
sobbing on his shoulder in his arms.
"It is a cursed country, a cursed country. There is no fair play."
And as Frances held her pliant form, meltingly exquisite in its maddeningness of woman, he remembered Henry in his canvas pants, barefooted under his floppy sombrero, digging holes in the sand of the bull. He tried to draw away from the armful of deliciousness, and only half succeeded. Still, at such slight removal of distance, he essayed the intellectual part rather than the emotional part he desired all too strongly to act.
"And now that I know at last what a frame-up is," he assured her, farthest from the promptings of his heart, "if these Latins of your country thought more coolly instead of acting so passionately, they might be building railroads and developing their country. That trial was a straight passionate frame-up. They just knew I was guilty, and were so eager to punish me that they wouldn't even bother for mere evidence or establishment of identity. Why delay? They knew Henry Morgan had knifed Alfaro. They knew I was Henry Morgan. When one knows, why bother to find out?"
Deaf to his words, sobbing and struggling to cling closer while he spoke, the moment he had finished, she was deep again in his arms, against him, to him, her lips raised to his, and ere he was aware, his own lips to hers.
"I love you! I love you!"
she whispered brokenly.
"No, no!" he denied what he most desired. "Henry and I are two alike. It is Henry you love, and I am not Henry."
She tore herself away from her own clinging, drew Henry's ring from her finger, and threw it on the floor. Francis was so beyond himself that he knew not what was going to happen the next moment, and was only saved from whatever it might be by the entrance of the commissario, watch in hand, with averted face, striving to see naught else than the moments registered by the second hand on the dial. She stiffened herself proudly, and all but broke down again as Frances slipped Henry's ring back on her finger and kissed her hand in farewell. Just ere she passed out the door, she turned, and with a whispered movement of the lips that was devoid of sound, told him,
"I love you."
Promptly, at the stroke of the clock, at 10 o'clock, Frances was led out into the jail patio, where stood the gallows. All San Antonio was joyously and shoutingly present, including much of the neighboring population, and Leoncia, Enrico Solano, and his 5 tall sons. Enrico and his sons fumed and strutted, but the jefe politico, backed by the commissario and his gendarme, was adamant. In vain, as Francis was forced to the foot of the scaffold, did Leoncia strive to get to him, and did her men strive to persuade her to leave the patio. In vain, also, did her father and brothers protest that Francis was not the man. The jefe politico smiled contemptuously, and ordered the execution to proceed. On top of the scaffold, standing on the trap, Francis declined the ministrations of the priest, telling him in Spanish that no innocent man being hanged needed intercessions with the next world, but that the men who were doing the hanging were in need of just such intercessions. They had tied Francis's legs, and were in the act of tying his arms, with the men who held the noose and the black cap hovering near to put them on him, when the voice of a singer was heard approaching from without, and the song he sang was, "Back to back against the mainmast, held at bay the entire crew." Leoncia, almost fainting, recovered at the sound of the voice, and cried out with sharp delight as she descried Henry Morgan entering, thrusting aside the guards at the gate, who tried to bar his way. At sight of him, the only one present who suffered chagrin was Torres, which passed unnoticed in the excitement. The populace was in accord with the jefe, who shrugged his shoulders and announced that one man was as good as another so long as the hanging went on. And here arose hot contention from the Solano men that Henry was likewise innocent of the murder of Alfaro. But it was Francis, from the scaffold, while his arms and legs were being untied, who shouted through the tumult,
"You tried me! You have not tried him! You cannot hang a man without trial! He must have his trial!"
And when Francis had descended from the scaffold and was shaking Henry's hand in both his own, the commissario, with a jefe at his back, duly arrested Henry Morgan for the murder of Alfaro Solano.
File 4.
Chapter 4.
"We must work quickly. That is the one thing sure," Francis said to the little conclave of Solanos on the piazza of the Solano Hacienda.
"One thing sure?"
Leoncia cried out scornfully, ceasing from her anguished pacing up and down.
"The one thing sure is that we must save him."
As she spoke, she shook a passionate finger under Francis's nose to emphasize her point. Not content, she shook her finger with equal emphasis under the noses of all and sundry of her father and brothers.
"Quick!" she flamed on. "Of course we must be quick! It is that, or—"
Her voice trailed off into the unvoiceable horror of what would happen to Henry if they were not quick.
"All gringos look alike to the jefe,"
Francis nodded sympathetically.
"She was splendidly beautiful and wonderful," he thought. "He certainly runs all San Antonio, and short shrift is his motto. He'll give Henry no more time than he gave us. We must get him out tonight."
"Now listen," Leoncia began again. "We Solanos cannot permit this execution. Our pride, our honour, we cannot permit it. Speak, any of you. Father, you suggest something."
And while the discussion went on, Francis, for the time being silent, wrestled deep in the throes of sadness. Leoncia's fervour was magnificent, but it was for another man, and it did not precisely exhilarate him. Strong upon him was the memory of the jail patio after he had been released and Henry had been arrested. He could still see, with the same stab at the heart, Leoncia in Henry's arms, Henry seeking her hand to ascertain if his ring was on it, and the long kiss of the embrace that followed.
"Ah, well," he sighed to himself, "he had done his best. After Henry had been led away, had he not told Leoncia, quite deliberately and coldly, that Henry was her man and lover, and the wisest choice for the daughter of the Solanos?"
But the memory of it did not make him a bit happy. Nor did the rightness of it. Right it was, that he never questioned, and it strengthened him into hardening his heart against her. Yet the right he found in his case to be the sorriest of consolation. And yet what else could he expect? It was his misfortune to have arrived too late in Central America, that was all, and to find this flower of a woman already annexed by a previous comer, a man as good as himself, and, his heart of fairness prompted, even better. And his heart of fairness compelled loyalty to Henry from him, to Henry Morgan, of the breed and blood, to Henry Morgan, the wildfire descendant of a wildfire ancestor, in canvas pants and floppy sombrero, with a penchant for the ears of strange young men, living on sea biscuit and turtle eggs, and digging up the bull and calf for old Sir Henry's treasure. And while Enrico Solano and his sons talked plans and projects on their broad piazza, to which Francis lent only half an ear, a house servant came, whispered in Leoncia's ear, and led her away around the L-shape of the piazza, where occurred a scene that would have excited Francis' risibilities and wrath. Around the L, Alvarez Torres, in all the medieval Spanish splendour of dress of a great hacienda owner, such as still obtains in Latin America, greeted her, bowed low with doffed sombrero in hand, and seated her in a rattan settee. Her own greeting was sad, but shot through with curiousness, as if she hoped he brought some word of hope.
"The trial is over, Leoncia," he said softly, tenderly, as one speaks of the dead. "He is sentenced. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock is the time. It is all very sad, most very sad, but—"
He shrugged his shoulders.
"No, I shall not speak harshly of him.
he was an honourable man. His one fault was his temper. It was too quick, too fiery. It led him into a mischance of honour. Never, in a cool moment of reasonableness, would he have stabbed Alfaro.
"He never killed my uncle,"
Leoncia cried, raising her averted face. "And it is regrettable," Torres proceeded gently and sadly, avoiding any disagreement. "The judge, the people, the jefe politico, unfortunately, are all united in believing that he did, which is most regrettable, but which is not what I came to see you about. I came to offer my service in any and all ways you may command. My life, my honour, are at your disposal. Speak, I am your slave." Dropping suddenly and gracefully onto one knee before her, he caught her hand from her lap and would have instantly flooded on with his speech, had not his eyes lighted on the diamond ring on her engagement finger. He frowned, but concealed the frown with bent face until he could drive it from his features and begin to speak.
"I knew you when you were small, Leoncia, so very, very charmingly small, and I loved you always. No, listen, please, my heart must speak. Hear me out. I loved you always. But when you returned from your convent, from schooling abroad, a woman, a grand and noble lady fit to rule in the house of the Solanos, I was burnt by your beauty. I have been patient. I refrained from speaking. But you may have guessed. You surely must have guessed. I have been on fire for you ever since. I have been consumed by the flame of your beauty, by the flame of you that is deeper than your beauty."
He was not to be stopped, as she well knew, and she listened patiently, gazing down on his bent head and wondering idly why his hair was so unbecomingly cut.